Arguing for Mr. Davis will be Attorney James M. Shello of Shello and Shello, Milwaukee. He gets 25 minutes, and then Ms. Marguerite Moeller, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, gets 30 minutes, and then Mr. Shello gets 5 minutes in rebuttal. So are you ready, counsel? You may proceed.
My name is James Shello. The lawyer seated at my right is Angela Kuchelski. Together we represent Glenn Davis, the petitioner in this cause. Mr. Davis stands charged with two counts of sexually assaulting a young daughter. In the trial court, we advised the court by notice that we intended to call as a witness Dr. Bronson Levin, who had examined the defendant and conducted a series of psychological tests, and that Dr. Levin was prepared to testify that in his opinion, a person who exhibited the character traits that were disclosed as a consequence of his interviews and tests would be unlikely to engage in sexually assaultive behavior with children. In response to that notice, the prosecution by Adam Gerol brought a motion to compel Mr. Davis to undergo a psychological or psychiatric examination by an expert of the state's choosing. On behalf of Mr. Davis, we objected to that motion on the grounds that the privilege of self-incrimination embodied in the constitutions of the United States and Wisconsin, and as interpreted by this court in State ex rel La Follette versus Raskin, would consider such a compelled examination to be an invasion of the Fifth Amendment privilege. The trial court agreed. The state was allowed to take an interlocutory appeal to the Court of Appeals, which reversed. We petitioned for review in this court, which was granted, and the state asked this court whether it would be willing to consider the underlying question of whether such character trait evidence adduced from an expert should lawfully be heard in the courts of Wisconsin, and the court agreed that that issue could be heard as well. And so that brings us up to date, and that's why we're here.
So, Attorney Shello, just a question. In 1998, we had the Richard AP, which, of course, is the genesis of allowing the testimony, the expert, to come in and testify on character evidence under 90404. I note that Wisconsin, at least according to the state's brief, is only one of three states that allows that. And then they have a whole, a dozen or more states they cite. Why should we continue to allow that evidence because of its, they say, its low probative value?
Well, first, as far as the low probative value is concerned, I don't think the state's met a burden on that. I think that the state has indicated, and I think that the briefs reflect, that there are some persons who believe that the tests and examinations of psychologists are valid and are able, within reasonable limits, to discern whether a person is likely to commit or to have committed sexual offenses with children. There are others who take a contrary view and say that the group of those who sexually assault children is so heterogeneous that a meaningful diagnostic procedure cannot, or at least has not, been developed. When this court says, is the test reliable enough? What this court is asking is a Daubert question. And we don't adopt Daubert in Wisconsin, at least we haven't up to today.
What is the test here?
The test here is the test of State versus Walstead as elaborated in State versus Peters. The test in Wisconsin is not the reliability of either the principles or the methodology, but it is the qualifications of the expert and the relevance of the opinion. The state in Richard A.P. conceded the relevance and the qualifications of this particular expert are not before the court. If this court were to say, let us see whether the weight of scientific thinking supports the state or supports the defendant, then it is engaging in the kind of multi-factor analysis that Daubert versus Merrill Dow and, more recently, Cumro Tyre has required for federal judges under Federal Rule of Evidence 702. That this court hasn't done. While we may be one of the three states which admit Richard A.P. evidence, we may be the only state which bases the admissibility of expert testimony on relevance. Granted, relevance is a factor that after going through the Daubert criteria and sometimes additional criteria such as those proposed by Judge Becker from the United States Court of Appeals of the Third Circuit, where he says not only must it be reliable, but there must be a nexus between the qualifications of the expert and the opinion which the expert proposes to give. So the answer is, first of all, why should we do it? Because the test in Wisconsin is one of relevance, and relevance is clear. Second of all, those jurisdictions which reject it for a whole variety of reasons, and that's set forth in the brief of the amicus as well as the brief of the Attorney General. Some states don't allow opinion evidence as to character traits, and so on. There's a whole variety of reasons. But we are here, and Richard A.P. is good law, and it should be. If this were a matter of first impression, if Richard A.P. hadn't been decided, I would argue to you that the evidence, the opinion evidence of an expert in this area as to whether or not a defendant possesses the traits of someone who is likely to commit sexual offenses of children is virtually the only defense that such a defendant has. What is he?
Suppose, Mr. Shellow, we didn't agree with that, and suppose that we said Richard A.P. was in error. How then, when you get to a sexual predator case, can the state prove that this person is a sexual predator who should be at least indefinitely detained?
It can't. And a good example is right here. The charges that are presently facing Mr. Davis, if he were convicted of those charges, would fall within the definition of sexually violent offenses. And he would be subject to commitment as a sexually violent person or sexual predator upon exactly the same opinion evidence which we seek to admit at the trial court.
Not exactly, counsel. I think it's the other side of the coin. As I understand the argument, in a sex predator case, we'd be hearing from an expert who says these character traits are present and that's predictive of future behavior of a sexually violent nature. And here it's the opposite that you're seeking to prove. And it's my understanding that the state's argument is that that science is no good and therefore that expert opinion testimony is not relevant.
The question is whether or not the methodology employed by the experts has too many false negatives or too many false positives. And if the state says that the methodology is not such that it can identify who is or is not a sexual predator, because, as Dr. Caldwell is quoted, the group is so heterogeneous, then this evidence doesn't go in either in a trial court or in a sexual predator hearing.
Well, as I understand the state's argument, though, is that the science is good enough to tell us who is, but it's not good enough to tell us who isn't.
No, I think the argument, if that footnote is read, at least as I read the footnote, it says in the case of serious sexual pathologies, the methodology is sound. In the case of less serious sexual pathologies, it's not. That's the way I read the footnote.
I thought you'd say if it can tell us who is, then everybody else is not.
Were I smarter, I would have. I've been giving a lot of thought to this case. And I intended to start, Mr. Justice Wilcox, with my conclusion and what I'd gotten with it, because I haven't been satisfied with my approach. I clearly am not satisfied with the Attorney General's approach. I'm not satisfied with the Court of Appeals' opinion. And for a long time, I fussed at, well, what in the world should the court do about it? And I finally figured out what the court ought to do about it. And so I'm going to start there, and then, if I have time, go back to some of these other interesting ideas. First of all, why I'm concerned. The Court of Appeals cases relied exclusively upon opinions that had evolved in cases in which the defendant admitted his or her guilt. And as a consequence, there really is no Fifth Amendment problem. Many of those cases are cases in which the defendant had been found guilty, and the question was whether he or she should be executed. None of the cases arose in jurisdictions which have the bifurcated trial procedure, which was endorsed by this court in the Schaffner, State Exwell, LaFollette versus Raskin.
What would be the procedure here? Certainly, you're not saying we should have a bifurcated trial.
Well, I suggested it in my brief, and I'm not suggesting it now. That in theory might work, but it sounds to me and it feels to me as though it's too cumbersome and it's impracticable. But as I drafted the reply brief and tried to figure out what would I do were I sitting on this court, that was one of the alternatives that I considered. I no longer am urging that alternative. Well, whatever solution this court comes up with, I think, it has to be a solution which, in a way, accommodates the concerns of the Attorney General and accommodates the Fifth Amendment privilege of the defendant.
And I take it that that is not what the state is suggesting, to allow your client to be examined by their expert, so we get into this so-called battle of experts. You don't want that, I take it.
Well, as far as the battle of experts is concerned, I think that that's a phrase that really has no point around here. Virtually every case in which an expert testifies is a battle of experts, whether we're talking about a case of damages or whether we're talking about a case of insanity or whether we're talking about a case of why a firearm discharge.
I didn't say necessarily that's a bad idea, but I'm just saying that that's the fallback position that the state is taking if we don't do away with AP, Richard AP, is that we should, in order to be, I don't want to say fundamentally fair, and that isn't really the issue, but to allow, how does the state, what do they do with the testimony that you want into the case?
All right. And that takes me to the solution that I have. First, to understand the solution, I think I have to formulate the state's concerns. My concerns are clear. The state is concerned primarily, and the Court of Appeals was concerned primarily, with a defendant being able to offer evidence of his prior social history, of his education, of his background, of his familial relations, of his relations with his children, through a surrogate, in a form not subject to cross-examination, and that this is unfair. That's the principal argument of the state. The state has an additional argument that says we ought to be able to have our own expert examine the defendant because that's the most effective way of putting this evidence before a jury rather than by cross-examination. That argument, I don't think, is that strong. And the reason I say it is because in Dish, for example, which I cite in my brief, the defendant complained that the sample which had been tested by the state's expert had been lost or wasn't available for testing by a defense expert. The defendant comes in and says, I want my expert to test it. And it's not there. It's not available. But he says, the defendant says, it's a denial of due process. And the attorney general argued in his brief, cross-examination of the state's expert who performed the test on the blood sample provides a more than adequate opportunity to challenge the technique he used and the reliability of the analysis.
Well, hold it. That's hard science. We're talking about soft science here, right? Isn't there a difference?
Is there a difference between hard science and soft science?
Well, I asked you first.
All right. May I answer?
You may if you stand in front of the microphone, Mr. Shelley. Go ahead.
Madam Chief Justice, may the time I take in answering the question of Justice Sykes be excluded from my 25 minutes.
No, make it a couple of seconds. Maybe you should say there is no difference.
She's doing it again.
All right.
I want to short circuit this.
All right. Professor Bridgman says there's no difference.
All right. That's better than you or
okay,
I.
So that's
okay.
Right. Look it up, answer.
Okay. All right. The state argues, not that the state argues, among other things, that the prima facie statute, the statute that makes prima facie the reliability of blood testing, carries the day. It doesn't carry the day. The Seventh Circuit in Henry B. Page, which was that habeas petition from Illinois in a drug case, which is cited in my brief, the same problem. The drugs were missing. The drugs were lost. The petitioner in the habeas says, hey, wait a minute, it's a denial of due process. This is an element of the offense. And the Seventh Circuit, without any presumption, without any prima facie, relying on Arizona v. Youngblood and Trombetta v. California, says, no, no due process denial.
Mr. Shelley, I've been waiting for your suggestion. Could we hear it?
Sure. But now that I've elaborate.
Now that we're anxious to hear it.
Well, I hope you are. I hope you are, because I gave a great deal of thought to this project. The answer is, let my expert testify. If he testifies to facts that he learned from the defendant, then the trial judge will instruct the jury that those matters which were learned by Dr. Levin from the defendant are not to be considered for their truth unless you hear testimony from some witness who has personal knowledge of those facts. And that solves the Attorney General's problem.
You think that solves the Attorney General's problem?
Yes.
Why is that? Why would that solve the problem?
Because if these facts are not admitted for their truth, then there's no right of confrontation or cross-examination that's impaired.
And that simply, or not simply, but then we would have from the judge an instruction.
Yes, sir.
And I know you've been in many, many jury trials. Do you think that instruction will be something the jury is going to listen very carefully to as they listen to all the judge's instructions?
Well, do I personally think that, or do courts? Well, let me quote my high school classmate, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. He was a class ahead of me. He's older than I am. In Parker versus Randolph, 442 U.S. 62 at page 73, Justice Rehnquist wrote, a crucial assumption underlying that system of trial by jury is that juries will follow the instructions given them by the trial judge. Were this not so, it would be pointless for a trial court to instruct a jury, and even more pointless for an appellate court to reverse a criminal conviction because the jury was improperly instructed.
Could I ask, Mr. Shelley, on Richard A.P. testimony?
Yes, sir.
Which I understand is admissible in California and Texas.
Yes.
How do they deal with the situation in those states?
I don't know the answer.
Brilliant scholar like you doesn't have the answer.
That is, I don't know if they give an instruction or if they have a general instruction for expert witnesses that says that the data relied on by an expert witness may be testified to by him but should not be taken as true unless there's extrinsic evidence in support thereof. That may be the way they handle it. I don't know the answer. I don't know that the issue's ever been raised. Remember, Wisconsin has State Ex Rel. Follett versus Raskin, which puts a gloss on expert testimony in cases involving the mind sciences. Does that warning light mean that I have...
You have 5 minutes.
You have 5 plus an additional 5 rebuttal.
I have 5 and 5. Yes. Madam Chief Justice, did you have a question?
Well, isn't there a way of getting the state to have an expert witness question your client and without using statements that he might make that were incriminating? I mean, you say that the expert witness, your expert witness, is going to get on the stand, and anything he says that the client says, don't consider them for the truth. Isn't there some way of doing that with the state's witness? This is all about the level playing field, whether you agree with that similarly or not. And
I think I've indicated that I don't agree with
it. I know.
It's not level. When you're out on it, it's quite clear that it's not level. But could there be an instruction? There could, but the violation is not only the question, but the compelled examination. That's what United States versus Davis at 93 F. 3rd said. Mr. Davis has a right not to be examined, as well as a right not to say anything.
Will you examine the defendants or accused for a competence to stand trial? And they have to see a psychologist or psychiatrist?
Yes, and the evidence adduced in those proceedings is not admissible on the issue of the defendant's guilt.
Yeah, that's what I'm driving at. So what can we do to get the expert witness of the state and not use the evidence for guilt?
That was the question that was originally posed as to whether we could bifurcate things. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, the issue that
that's
was sort
true.
Of floating.
We can't bifurcate for the reasons you set forth, I don't think.
I don't
at the
think
moment.
You can bifurcate. And so I don't think you can say, disregard the statements that have been secured by a state's witness, by a state's expert. That's not going to solve the Fifth Amendment problem.
Okay.
Now,
Mr. Shello.
Yes, sir.
If the jury is to be instructed that they are not to accept those statements, accept those statements for the truth stated therein, for what purpose is the jury then instructed that they are supposed to take them?
I would ask that the jury be instructed as follows. You have heard from an expert witness who testified to his opinion that the defendant does not possess those characteristics and those traits which make it likely that he would engage in sexual offenses upon children. In considering this opinion, you should not consider the facts upon which the expert relied to the extent that he learned these facts from the defendant as being true. The expert assessed these facts and on these facts based his opinion. You are not required to accept his opinion, but you should give it such weight as, in view of all of the evidence you have heard, as you feel it is entitled to. If, on the other hand, you hear testimony from persons who have personal knowledge of the facts to which this expert testified, then you may consider the truth of the credibility of that testimony in weighing the opinion of the expert. I think my 25 minutes are up.
I do too, sir. You may be seated. Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mueller, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. The two issues confronting the court in today's appeal are both weighty. The first issue, however, if this is decided the way the state is asking this court to, eliminates the need for this court to ever reach the second issue. And therefore, I'd like to begin by arguing that this court should take this opportunity to overrule the Court of Appeals decision in State versus Richard AP. And I think before getting into the reasons for why that decision should be overruled, I think it's important to at least briefly touch upon the kind of testimony that was at issue there, because it's been categorized as expert character evidence. And I think it's important as a starting point to realize that the type of testimony proposed to be put on there differs fundamentally from the kind of character evidence that we're accustomed to dealing with. Now, normally you talk about character evidence in relationship to pre-existing, and I mean existing before commission of the charged crime, pre-existing knowledge that other people have about the defendant, either via reputation or by opinion. It's based on observable conduct of the defendant. In addition, character evidence usually has a moral connotation to it. What is a person's character for truth and veracity? What is a person's character for being law-abiding, for being peaceable? In contrast to this kind of lay character evidence that we're all familiar with, the type of expert or professional character evidence that we were dealing with in Richard AP and that we are dealing with in this case is evidence that is really manufactured in preparation for trial. The witness through whom this character evidence is going to be presented in most cases has never laid eyes on the defendant prior to the defendant being charged with a crime. The person is hired specifically to test the defendant, give psychological tests, conduct interviews, and perhaps that person's exposure to the defendant might be only a matter of hours, in contrast to the lay character witness who may have known the defendant for 10 years, 15 years, has been a member of the same community, the same workforce, the same neighborhood. So you're dealing with a very different species of evidence. In addition, if you look at the offer of proof that was made in Richard AP and the offer of proof that was made in this case, I don't think it's really accurate to say that both facets of the expert's testimony qualify as character evidence under 904.041A. Insofar as Dr. Levin would testify that Mr. Davis does not have the character traits of a pedophile, that arguably is character evidence. But insofar as he would be willing to go further and state that it is unlikely that a person without these character traits would sexually molest a child, that certainly is expert opinion testimony under 907.02. But I don't think it's character evidence. And I think you can see that if you compare it to the usual lay character witness who says, I've known the defendant for 15 years. In my opinion, he is a very truthful person. The lay character witness does not go further and say, because he is a truthful person, I think it's less likely that he forged these checks, or I think it's less likely that he perjured himself. That goes beyond what the usual definition of character evidence is. And I think both in Richard AP and in this case, the proffered expert testimony is not just coming in under 904.041A, but it goes further, and the second half would only be the expert testimony under 907.02. Now, keeping those distinctions in mind, I think that leads to the state's reasons for why Richard AP should be overruled. First, the legal underpinnings of Richard AP. If you look at that decision, the two cases on which the Court of Appeals relied were decisions of this court in King versus State and State versus Polizzano. Now, in King, this court simply stated, because it was not really the issue there, that the doctor's testimony that because King was a passive-aggressive personality, that it was unlikely that he intended to kill his wife when he shot her to death, that was character evidence. Well, I think the testimony there went far beyond character evidence, and it really approached the kind of evidence that this court later ruled was inadmissible in Wisconsin, in the Steele case, it very closely approached expert testimony on capacity to form intent. There was a slight difference, admittedly, because what the expert in King was saying is that I have examined King, I've looked at the police reports, I've looked at the witnesses' statements, and all of the circumstances existing at the time he shot his wife were not sufficient to provoke him to want to kill her. Therefore, it's more likely that this was an accidental shooting. That goes far beyond what character evidence is. So I think insofar as Richard A.P. was relying on King, the basis for that decision itself is suspect in light of this court's later decision in Steele, which followed King by several years. The second case that Richard A.P. relied on was this court's decision in Polizzano. The issue in Polizzano was whether the prosecutor had improperly said during his closing argument that because Ms. Polizzano had been sexually abused as a child, it was more likely that she sexually abused the children she was charged with assaulting. This court found that the prosecutor spoke improperly because there had to be expert testimony linking her prior abuse to the fact that she'd be more likely to turn around and abuse children. And in the course of making that statement, this court indicated that that type of testimony would be character evidence under 904.041A. And I respectfully disagree with that conclusion because whether or not you've been sexually abused by your parent or by somebody else when you were a child doesn't go to your character. It doesn't mean that you're moral or immoral, honest or dishonest. It might be something in your background that could explain your behavior at a later date, but it's not truly character evidence. So insofar as the AP court also relied on Polizzano, I think that reliance was misplaced. Now, in terms of probative value or relevance, I think if you look at an example that is taken out of the realm of psychiatric or psychological testimony, it becomes more apparent, and I admittedly it took me quite a while to figure out how to get this point across, and I hope that this is a convincing example. If you look at demographics in terms of who commits particular crimes, if you look at something like armed robberies, and I'm making up these statistics in terms of their absolute numbers, but I think this court recognizes that most armed robbers are males and that usually they fall within a certain age category, perhaps 18 to 40. So if we had a statistician who was willing to say that 95% of armed robbers are males in this age group, and we had a defendant who happened to be a 75-year-old grandmother, would she be able, in an effort to show the jury that I did not rob this bank, would she be able to put on her statistician to say that odds are this robbery was done by a male who fell within that, you know, age group? Odds are it was not done by a 75-year-old female. What kind of probative value would that have?
I don't know, but we have a state case which the witness put on by the state testified that something like 90% of those who recanted, and there was a witness who recanted, found out that they were truthful the first time they said it. I think that was the testimony. State said that was probative. In fact, objected to when somebody wanted to bring in an expert witness to say, hey, just because 90% do it doesn't mean this defendant did it. Or, I'm sorry, this witness did it.
And my
familiar with that case?
I am familiar with the case, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but my recollection is that the only reason it was relevant in that case was because for some reason the defendant had done something to open the door to that. But the indication in the court's opinion was that were it not for this door opening, that wouldn't have come in. And in fact, I can tell the court that I recently wrote a brief in the Court of Appeals where I conceded that evidence should not have come in, which indicated that something like, I can't remember the exact number, but only 2% of reports of sexual assault were false. I think it arose in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel, and I made the concession that this evidence probably should not have come in, but as usual, I argued that it was harmless there. But
we're familiar with that argument.
Yeah. But in any event,
concession.
But in any event, I agree. If there hasn't been a door opening, that the example the Chief Justice just gave illustrates the fact that you don't put in profile evidence. And I think part of the problem in these cases is that not just counsel, but also this court, and I've done it, commentators have done it, use the term character evidence and profile evidence as if those were identical concepts or congruent concepts. And I don't think that's accurate. I think that there's definitely an overlap, but certainly when you're looking at a profile, like the FBI might look at a profile for a serial killer, and for whatever reason, most serial killers happen to be white males. I don't think the fact that you're white or the fact that you're a male goes to your character. It's certainly a characteristic. It's part of a profile that's developed for investigative purposes. But it isn't the same thing as saying that you have a certain character trait. So I think this goes back to why not only is the underpinning of Richard A.P. legally faulty, it illustrates why the probative value of this kind of evidence is extremely low.
Is there any difference between the proposition that if you fit the profile, then that evidence is relevant to whether or not you could have committed the crime charged, and if you don't fit the profile, that evidence is relevant to whether or not you committed the crime charged?
Well, I think if you're referring to predictive value in terms of future dangerousness, I think that's an entirely different question, because you're not looking backward in that case to say whether did you do this particular crime. You're assessing risk. And if there are studies, and I'm not as familiar with all those studies that they use in Chapter 980 proceedings.
Yeah, I'm not talking about risk assessment in Chapter 980 or other similar proceedings. I'm talking about relevance to a determination of guilt or innocence of a crime charge. And I'm thinking, I guess, as an analogy, the law on admissibility of prior convictions if a defendant testifies. The defendant, if he testifies, can be cross-examined on the number of prior convictions that he has.
Because the theory being that you're less credible the more convictions that you have.
Right, but he can't testify that I've never been convicted of a crime, so you should believe me here. Right?
Right.
I mean, isn't that the law?
That's right. Because the fact that you haven't been convicted of a crime might just be, I think, happenstance. Maybe you never got caught. So the relevant value is less than when you have been proven to have been convicted of a crime. And the assumption is that people who are convicted, at least of particular crimes, or if they're fairly recent, that they are less credible. So I think that you're correct, that the presumption, or the relevance, rather, doesn't necessarily work both ways. In other words, you can have a huge pool of people who have committed the crime of sexual assault, and maybe 25% of them test as normal, and 75% don't. And so the jury really is being asked to decide, did you do this particular crime? And what good does it really do them to know that you don't fit into the 75% that do have these aberrations? They have to decide whether you're in the 25% that don't.
What's the reason for the character of the accused exception to the general rule against the character propensity inference?
My understanding is that the character evidence rule that allows a defendant to put his good character in issue goes way back to when juries were drawn among a community of peers who would actually know the defendant. And so you'd have these people vouching for your good character, and members of the jury would be likely to know some of those witnesses. And you just more or less had this common law right, I guess, to show that because other people in the community thought you were a law-abiding person, it was less likely that you would have committed whatever crime you were charged with. That's my understanding.
Counsel, I don't want to get you away from Richard A.P., but I want to bring up a question as far as opposing counsel indicating, let's say, for example, the court does retain Richard A.P., but then you have your second position, which would be all right, then we would like our expert to be able to testify. Opposing counsel said, well, no, how about this? We'll have a jury instruction, and we will give the jury, say, well, you won't consider this evidence if someone directly testifies. What about that position? Do you think that's workable?
I don't find it tenable whatsoever. This is the first time I've heard of it, because originally Mr. Shello was saying that bifurcation, and that was what he said in his reply brief, that that was the answer, and now he realizes the folly of his ways. But in terms of a jury instruction, I don't think it works, because when you've got an expert testifying, I think it's virtually impossible to distinguish what portion or what percentage of that ultimate opinion is based on statements that the defendant made to him. I mean, when you give an opinion that somebody doesn't have the character traits of a pedophile, you're looking at a variety of psychological standardized tests. You're looking at a sexual history that was taken from the defendant. You're looking at his statements about just a variety of personal matters. And I don't know how a prosecutor would possibly effectively cross-examine someone by saying, well, what portion of your opinion is based on what the patient told you, and then what did the patient tell you? I mean, it doesn't seem to be a realistic way of approaching it. And when Mr. Shallow gave that jury instruction that he suggested, I had a difficult time following exactly what I, as a juror, was supposed to do. And I don't know to what extent a juror can evaluate the strength of the expert's opinion if you have to say, okay, now we're going to pretend like two-thirds of it or one-third of it isn't really true. He took it as true in making this opinion, but now we don't know that it's true, and you're not to regard it as true. I think it's very confusing.
The reason I'm asking is that let's assume, and many years ago I handled a bifurcated trial but with psychiatric testimony, et cetera, but let's say you look at the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, you look at the Rorschach test. I'm wondering how they would break those questions out when they go as to character, and how would you distinguish that?
Mm-hmm. And I frankly don't know how they... base their opinion on a number of these tests. If one test is considered to be, you know, more important, I know that, for example, with the MMPI, I think it's that people who commit certain sex offenses generally score higher on or are elevated on a couple of the different axes for that test. But I think by telling a jury you can't consider anything that the defendant told the psychologist for the truth of the matter asserted, well, I don't think that you normally would even get into every single thing that the person told the psychologist. I don't know that the psychologist would even remember every single thing, and it would just be very difficult to conduct any kind of cross-examination.
What I'm getting at, there's for each test, there's a what little I know about it, there's a specific number of questions as to the MMPI and Rorschach, and I was just... The difficulty I was having with the opposing counsel's suggestion was how you would break that down, knowing that those are standard, there is a standardized test, at least that's my understanding, and certain questions that most people in the field would be asking of the defendant. Not just this defendant, but any defendant.
I think that's a definite problem, but there's also a problem in that different psychologists don't necessarily use the same test. I mean, some would favor one particular test. Another would say, that's not as good. Maybe there's something more advanced we're going to go to.
Counsel, why can't you just make all these arguments by cross-examination and by argument to the jury? You know, juries are pretty smart. In fact, the person, the young woman who won... She trusted the 12 people more than she would trust a single judge, especially a single judge who might have had this juvenile delinquent before the judge previously, and then would think that just because the person did one crime, that they did another, and so wanted to rely on the jury. So, you know, you have hypothetical questions before an expert witness, right? And if the jury doesn't think the hypothetical question is close enough to the facts in the case, jury isn't going to take the expert's advice, right? Doesn't have to be bound by the expert, correct?
Doesn't have to be bound by it, and I think it's probably told that. But I think this court has recognized, and so has the Court of Appeals, that an examining expert, when you're talking about any kind of psychological evaluation, whether it's for this purpose or, as in the Court of Appeals decision in Mayday, whether it was for the purpose of examining the victims, that a jury is going to give greater weight to an examining expert than to an expert who simply tries to chip away at the examining expert's opinion. And in terms of cross-examination, I think the efficacy varies tremendously. When you've got somebody who's what I consider a professional character witness,
and the jury knows about that because they saw Law and Order and all these other cases, so they know they're professional witnesses. They come in with trust and distrust. They know the difference between what some call hard science and other soft science. Very smart.
Well, I think only if they watch certain programs. If they're more into the family sitcoms, then they're probably not going to have that knowledge. But
oh, you can ask that on Voir Dire.
You can't. You could ask a lot of this on Voir Dire, but I think the point is that this evidence has such low probative value that we don't want to get into tying up, first of all, the offer of proof. I mean, before you ever get to the trial, if you allow Richard A.P. testimony in, individual trial judges can still keep it out under principles of relevance.
That's what I was going to ask you. And Richard A.P., do you read that case as talks about a clearly erroneous exercise of discretion, but do you read that case as saying that in every case in which this kind of evidence is presented, that exclusion of it would be an erroneous exercise of discretion?
Absolutely not.
So it's not required. Trial judges could still exclude this.
Right. I think if the trial judge made the appropriate record, and the case I cited in my brief, State versus Walters, has exactly that issue. If the trial judge decides that the probative value is outweighed by unfair prejudice or needless consumption of time and makes a good record, I think that'll be sustained as an appropriate exercise of discretion. In Richard A.P., the problem was the only reason the judge gave for keeping it out was he said that it had to be an absolute proposition, that unless the psychologist could say it was impossible for somebody without a diagnosable sexual disorder to molest a child, that then he couldn't testify. And that was why the Court of Appeals found that that was an erroneous exercise of discretion.
You keep coming back to the words low probative value, both in your brief and today. And yet, as I'm sure you're aware, that is not the test. Wisconsin, the test is relevancy.
Well, the
and relevancy, if I may, is any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence more or more probable or less probable. Now, with your emphasis on low probative value, I'm hearing you say there is relevancy here. Now, are you saying that it's not relevant?
I'm saying that whether there is any relevance at all would depend on the specific offer of proof. But in any event, it would never be above minimal relevance. But I think in addition to the statute that you just cited on relevance, because we're talking about expert testimony, the standard is also found in 90702. And the testimony has to either assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence or to determine the fact in issue. The first half of that, I don't think there can be any argument that expert testimony on a defendant's character for non-deviance somehow is necessary to assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence. The evidence in a case like this is going to be similar to the kind of evidence you had in Richard A.P., where it's basically the victim saying the defendant sexually assaulted me on numerous occasions, and the defendant saying I never touched her. So having this expert testimony doesn't help you to understand that evidence. I think that type of expert testimony we're talking about is when you've got physical evidence and you need an expert to interpret it, like DNA evidence. You need somebody to explain to the jury what this means, like what does the presence of the defendant's DNA on these items mean, or the absence of DNA on these items mean. So I don't think the first half applies. The question is, does it help to determine a fact in issue? Well, the fact in issue is, did this defendant sexually assault the girl, in this case his daughter? And the fact that the defendant doesn't have the characteristics of a pedophile does very little to say whether he assaulted his daughter, because you don't have to be a pedophile to engage in that kind of conduct. I mean, this court knows that there are a lot of reasons why people sexually assault children. Sometimes it is because they have a sexual interest in them.
Isn't that, as the Chief Justice pointed out, something that can be brought out in cross-examination? Why exclude it completely?
Why exclude? I think for the same reason that this court excluded wholesale polygraph evidence in the Dean case or psychological evidence on capacity to form intent in the Steele case. I think on public policy grounds, when you look at all the downside of putting on this evidence, including the fact, and I haven't really gotten to the second issue here.
What is the second issue?
The second issue is whether a defendant who says he's going to put on Richard A.P. testimony can be forced to submit to a psychological exam by a state expert and have the results of that exam used against him if he goes ahead and puts on Richard A.P.
And what do they do in Texas and California?
I frankly have to claim ignorance, too, in terms of whether they actually give some kind of a jury instruction. I don't know what they do in those states. In Texas, they don't even consider it character evidence, though. They consider it expert testimony, but in Nolte, the court said this is not even character evidence. So what
would be the most permanent authority that you would cite for the proposition that the state should be able to counter with its own expert after examination of the defendant?
I think it's difficult to put my finger on one particular case because there is no case that is directly on point, partly because since Wisconsin is only one of three states that allows this type of testimony, you wouldn't expect the precise issue to have arisen. I think the Janus case out of South Dakota certainly supports us and stands for the proposition that when you put on psychological testimony on the issue of guilt, which is what this evidence would be used for here, that you waive your right against self-incrimination. Now, in Janus, they didn't have to ask that the defendant submit to a exam by a state expert because he had made terribly incriminating statements to this Dr. Page, and the defense, by putting in Dr. Page's testimony, was held to have waived any right against self-incrimination.
Why do you need a countervailing expert here? Why can't you...
That subjects the defendant to an examination. Why can't the state rely upon an expert to sit in court, read the transcript, and then testify based upon the expert who has made these evaluations, and simply state, well, those are no good for the following reasons. You don't have to subject the defendant to an examination and force the defendant to potentially incriminate themselves. And at the same time, you've got all this evidence that the defense expert is testifying to. Why isn't that satisfactory?
Because, number one, I think by putting in this kind of evidence, the defendant is waiving the right against self-incrimination.
Well, that's not my question. My question is, why is this not satisfactory? Right?
I think in some cases it might be, but we don't know that. And I think, generally speaking, this court has acknowledged, and the Court of Appeals in Mayday has acknowledged, that the fact finder is usually going to give the nod to the examining expert. You always believe that the person who heard it from the horse's mouth...
Who says that?
Well, I think the Court of Appeals in Mayday felt that it wasn't sufficient for Mayday...
Isn't that soft science?
It's like, I think it is extremely soft science.
And without even an expert. I mean, how do we know how many times that's true or not?
We don't, for sure. But I think that the court has recognized that there's this aura of scientific reliability that surrounds psychological testimony, even though maybe we all know better. But a juror who's sitting there for the first time in the jury box and might not have the exposure that lawyers and judges do might be taken in by, especially when you get somebody who's an accomplished expert witness who testifies as part of their, you know, everyday work experience in courtrooms and can make a very good impression on juries. I see my time has run up. We ask this court in the first instance to overrule Richard A.P., or if not, to uphold the Court of Appeals decision giving us the right to a reciprocal exam. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Assistant Attorney General Mueller. Mr. Scheller, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
My memory was, I think, accurate, and the footnote to which I invited the attention of Justice Sykes is footnote 3, page 16 of the Attorney General's brief. The application of Steele, of this court's opinion in Steele, suggested by the Attorney General, I think, overlooks the complexity of the Steele opinion. The Steele opinion, woven through it, was the concern that psychologists and psychiatrists, when they use the word intent, may not and probably do not use it in the same sense that lawyers and judges use the word, and that this difference, this difference in discipline terminology made it difficult to accept the testimony of mental health sciences on whether a defendant had the capacity to form the intent, leaving aside, of course, to some extent that's undercut by the exception that Steele permitted, and that is that where the defendant relies on voluntary intoxication as a defense, the expert may testify that as a consequence of that, he did not have the capacity to form the specific intent to commit the crime. The most interesting facet of the argument by the state were really the responses by Mr. Justice Wilcox and the Chief Justice. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I wish that were more oral arguments, not because we can convince judges of things or justices of things, but because it makes us think. And maybe we're better lawyers as a consequence. Why not? Why not do it with a hypothetical question? How does that invade any confrontation rights that conceivably the state has? And just as a footnote to that, and I can't find the case. All I can do is assure the court that it's out there. I've read it. I know the court it came from. But even with computers, I can't find it. There was a case that said, the case from the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, that says that the prosecution, that the plaintiff in a criminal action does not have the right of confrontation. One of these days I'll find the case, and when I do, I'll send it to you. But in any event, does not the hypothetical question approach, which was, I think, impliedly suggested by Justice Wilcox and Chief Justice Abrahamson, give us another possible way of resolving the issue? Don't civil lawyers who ask hypothetical questions of experts all the time, don't they receive instructions that to the extent that the facts are not established which form the hypothetical, to that extent you may reject the opinion based upon the hypothetical?
Can I ask this question? Is it a given that the battery of tests, whatever they may be, that will be administered by your expert and testified to by him, necessarily involves evidentiary facts from the defendant's mouth such that an implied waiver of the Fifth Amendment privilege by way of the back door?
No, and clearly we would give the results of those tests, of any tests given to the defendant, those results would be made available to the prosecution, and the prosecution was so advised of that. I think the question, if I'm correctly reading Justice Sykes, if the question is, will the defendant be asked questions beyond those questions which appear in formulated and standardized tests, the answer is yes. And
in front of the microphone, please.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
I thought you were pointing at the red light.
You can answer the question, but you said if it involves more than the formulaic.
Yes, and in this case it has. The defendant has been tested and evaluated by the expert. And the expert did give an entire battery of psychological tests, in addition to which he conducted extensive interviews of the defendant.
And none of that involves the collection of what we would consider, as judges and lawyers, evidentiary facts?
Oh, no. For example, the defendant would tell the expert, this is where I went to school, these are the courses that I studied, these are the people with whom I studied, and so on. These are evidentiary facts.
I guess I'm referring to evidentiary facts about the crime charged.
Unlike all of the other cases, the defendant didn't commit this crime. There are no evidentiary facts to discuss.
Well, does he say that what his relationship with these children
were,
sure, whether or not these children were truthful, whether or not a spouse has a reason to create havoc in the family? Those are the kinds of
all of that was
stuff
discussed.
That's more,
yes,
fundamental, such as where were you at thus and such a date, at thus and such a time, when your daughter says you touched her improperly, and what were you doing, and where were you when the allegation?
That I don't know whether he asked that specific question, but he certainly asked the questions that the Chief Justice has suggested.
He could have asked those questions.
He did ask them, and he learned about the divorce, and he learned about the problem.
No, but I mean, he might have asked the questions that Justice Sykes said.
And he might have.
Well, and to the extent that he testifies about those in connection with rendering his opinion from the witness stand, why should it not be construed as a waiver such that the state gets an equal crack at it?
If he were to attempt to put in an alibi, is that your point? If he were to attempt to put in an alibi through a surrogate, would he have waived Is Fifth Amendment right? I don't think so. I don't think so in the face of an instruction to a jury saying you may not accept this evidence that he was in Oklahoma City at the time for its truth.
Yeah, I'm not really even suggesting something as strong as an alibi, just, you know, sort of even facts that constitute his denial of having committed the offense. I mean, I think that's what the Court of Appeals opinion stands for, that this examination and the expert's testimony about the examination constitutes a waiver of the Fifth Amendment privilege because it's a backdoor introduction of the defendant's denial.
The defendant's denial is in the arraignment when he says not guilty.
Well, I know, but it's words coming from his mouth through a surrogate on the witness stand.
Without the right of cross-examination by the state.
Right.
All I can say is to the extent that it's a factual assertion, to that extent my instruction solves it. If, in fact, the expert were to testify and the defendant told me that he didn't commit these crimes, then there might be a waiver. Maybe.
So we should revisit this after the expert's report is rendered? I mean, I'm not suggesting that.
Well, it's such a great pleasure being here. I would guess. I would suggest you... No. If you want the off-the-wall suggestion as to what I'd really like the court to do, in addition to everything else, is I'd like you to overrule Walstead, overrule Peters, decide that Daubert is the law of this state, that Kumrow is the law of this state, and send this back for a Daubert hearing. That's what you ought to do. Thank you.
I think we need supplemental briefs. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll file a supplemental.
Not yet. Thank you, Mr. Shell. Thank you, Assistant Attorney General Moe.